Hey there, you're listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. I'm Zen Hess. Thanks for listening today. Our guest today is Dr. Neil Messer, who recently joined the faculty here in the Religion Department at Baylor University. Dr. Messer is a theological ethicist by trade, but as you'll find out, his academic journey is pretty unique. His academic journey has set him up very well to think about how Christian theology might engage with issues that are being raised by developments in neuroscience. For instance, how might Christians respond to questions about privacy as it relates to brain imaging technology? These are the sorts of things we'll speak about today. Neil Messer is professor of theological bioethics here at Baylor University, and he's an ordained minister of the United Reformed Church in the UK. He's authored and edited numerous books on neuroethics and other ethical topics. Most recently, a book called Science and Technology: Encounters Between Science and the Christian Tradition. Enjoy our conversation. Dr. Neil Messer, thank you so much for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's good to be with you.
So would you tell us a little bit about your story? What did the road to becoming a theological ethicist look like for you?
Well, I began my academic life in the biological sciences. I did an undergraduate degree in biochemistry and then a PhD in molecular biology. Uh-huh. And when I started my PhD, I had every intention of pursuing an academic career in that field, in molecular biology, if I could. Back then in the UK, it wasn't so easy. There weren't so many openings, but that was what I really wanted to do. And what happened was that in about the beginning of the final year of my PhD, my scientific career plans got rudely interrupted by a call to ordained ministry in my denomination.
Which is what?
It's the United Reformed Church, which is a combination of, it's a union of Presbyterian and Congregationalist traditions.
Oh, okay.
So over here, I'm a Presbyterian. And this was something I'd thought about from time to time before, but kind of put to the back of my mind because my aim and aspiration was an academic career in biochemistry and molecular biology. As I say, that got interrupted in a sense, quite suddenly, when my thinking about my own future sort of shifted for various reasons, and I started exploring a call to ministry with my church. Mm-hmm. The upshot of that was that I was accepted as a candidate for ministry, and as soon as I finished my PhD, I began my ministry training.
From one school to the next,
which was also in Cambridge. I'd done my PhD in Cambridge, and I stayed in Cambridge to do my ministry training. But that was where I first encountered the academic study of theology, and while I was a research student in molecular biology. While I was a graduate student, I'd already been aware of the various questions that my Christian faith or my scientific work was raising for my Christian faith. Mm-hmm. Both, if you like, apologetic questions and I think more saliently for me, ethical questions that were even then beginning to emerge about molecular biology, about human genetics, and related areas. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking at the time that as a scientist working in this field, who was also a practicing Christian, mm-hmm. I ought to have opinions about these questions.
Right.
But I became uncomfortably aware that I didn't have the faintest idea how to go about forming these opinions. Mm-hmm. So when I started studying theology, I was very eager to take the opportunity to return to some of this unfinished business and explore some of these questions further. So I did some work in bioethics during my mm-hmm. ministry training. I did a research project on the ethics of human genetic modification, and that. That kind of work led me into the study of theological ethics more broadly, and got me really fascinated mm-hmm. by theological ethics as a theological subdiscipline. Yeah. Once I finished my ministry training, after I was ordained and serving in a local church, I did some further graduate studies in Christian ethics, mm-hmm. because by then I'd come to the conclusion that I felt quite drawn to some kind of academic
right.
role or some kind of academically focused ministry, mm-hmm. Though I didn't know at that
right.
stage exactly what that looked like. So I wanted to do some further studies to equip myself for that. And pretty much as soon as I'd finished my graduate studies in Christian ethics, I found myself doing some part-time teaching in a seminary not too far away from where I was ministering.
Great.
And from there, I moved into a full-time seminary teaching job, and then into a series of university positions, teaching theology and ethics.
Great. Wow. So a story of finding a calling, mm-hmm. ministerial calling, tied up in academic work and research, both in science and theology. Fascinating. And so your current research is largely focusing on neuroethics, mm-hmm. and you describe that as a relatively recent arrival on the ethical scene. I think of lots of ethical conversations as being quite old, so it's nice to have something maybe a bit fresh. Can you give us some background here? What is neuroethics, and why has it only recently emerged on the scene?
Well, it's recently emerged because neuroscience itself has, at any rate, grown and expanded mm-hmm. enormously just in very very recent times, really. So I guess the 1990s was a period of great expansion and advance in neuroscience. And it became clear that this expanding field of neuroscience was raising all kinds of questions, apparently mm-hmm. new problems for and about ethics. Mm-hmm. So very early in the 21st century, in 2002, there was a big symposium convened to look into this mm-hmm. this emerging set of questions and problems, and that was really the founding event of this new field of neuroethics. Mm-hmm. The term neuroethics really started to be used during and after that symposium. Mm-hmm. There was a short but really important article published by one of the founders of the field around the same time, shortly okay. afterwards, which really marked out this new discipline. And that's really how it began. So the term neuroethics really names a field that brings together a range of, you could say, both theoretical and practical mm-hmm. questions for ethics and questions about ethics that are raised by current and emerging neuroscience and neurotechnology.
Great.
So that article that I mentioned by a scholar called Adina Roskies, which really served as a kind of founding charter for neuroethics, divided the field into what Roskies called the ethics of neuroscience and the neuroscience of ethics. So the ethics of neuroscience is the more obvious side of it, maybe. It's that aspect of neuroethics that's concerned with ethical questions about the practice of neuroscience, how neuroscientific research should be conducted, how neurotechnologies should and shouldn't be used, what kinds of interventions in the function of functioning of human and other brains, should or shouldn't be permitted. That kind of practical ethical question. But there's this other side to neuroethics, which Roskies called the neuroscience of ethics, because the distinctive thing about neuroethics is it doesn't only raise these practical questions about an area that an area of work that comes very close to human identity and human being and experience in all kinds of ways. Neuroscience also raises a whole lot of questions about ethics itself, because it promises to teach us more about what it means to be moral agents.
Right.
It offers to teach us more about moral experience, moral judgment, how we make moral judgments, how we act on them, and as well as shedding light on more familiar and more time-honored questions about determinism, free will, moral responsibility, and so on.
Yeah.
So you've got this this side of neuroethics, which is about what neuroscience can tell us about ethics.
Right.
And as Roskies pointed out in that founding article, some of the most intriguing questions in neuroethics arise when these two sides of the field intersect and interact. So you have practical ethical questions about, for example, the combination of neurotechnologies with artificial intelligence and machine learning, the development of brain computer interfaces and so on. So that there are practical ethical discussions about how these technologies should be used, and there are practical ethical issues about various concerns like mental privacy and so on that are raised by these these emerging technologies.
Right.
But also these technologies are raising and foregrounding much more profound questions about human identity, individual identity, and again, moral agency and responsibility.
Right.
So you have these two sides of the field intersecting.
It's a fascinating interplay. And you've mentioned several times here neurotechnologies. And I think that you mentioned in one of your essays that the kind of boom in neuroscience in the 90s, that related largely to the development of brain imaging technologies. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a fascinating intersection not only of neuroscience and neuroethics, but the ethics of technologies. There's a lot of really important stuff here. So we've already kind of tipped into the question of why you think that neuroethics is so important. But I'm curious how Christian ethicists in those very earliest years, 2002 is kind of where you have pinned the conversation kind of getting its, if not its actual origin, its kind of momentum, maybe. So how were Christian ethicists engaging with questions of neuroethics in the early 2000s?
Well, the short answer is very little. It's one of these extraordinary things which I noticed very soon after I started getting interested in neuroethics, was just how little engagement there'd been with neuroethics mm-hmm. as a field by Christian ethicists. Which is not to say that some of the questions discussed by neuroethicists hadn't also been discussed by Christian ethicists. So neuroethics is obviously quite closely related to bioethics, though neuroethicists tend to insist that it is a distinct field or subfield in its own right. But some of the questions that are discussed by neuroethicists have been around for longer than the field of neuroethics itself. Yeah. I mean, and some of them have certainly come within the purview of bioethicists.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a big area of discussion, for example, about disorders of consciousness like the permanent vegetative state,
mm-hmm.
How patients with disorders of consciousness should be treated
right.
and so forth. Now that's a discussion that's been going on since before, mm-hmm. Well before 2002.
Of course.
And it's a familiar area of discussion to Christian bioethicists as well as others. But there's also been a fair amount of engagement by theologians working in the science and theology, science and religion mm-hmm. fields, with neuroscience and the some of the theological implications of neuroscience,
mm-hmm.
but they tended not to get involved so much in the ethical debates. Again, that they did to some extent.
Sure.
An author like Nancy Murphy, for example. Mm-hmm. Has written a fair amount on questions of free will and responsibility. So there were those odd incursions by Christian ethicists, but as for engagement with neuroethics as a field,
mm-hmm.
It seems there was practically none,
or
very, very little. And this wasn't just a kind of one-sided avoidance, as it were. My sense was, and is, I think, that the field of neuroethics and scholars within neuroethics have mm-hmm. been quite happy to get along without theologians as well. It's
sure.
often been a fairly secular field.
Yeah.
So in my book, Theological Neuroethics, I talk about this mutual neglect mm-hmm. of neuroethics and theological ethics, which I suggest is to the detriment of both.
You are listening to Currents in Religion, and I'm speaking with Neil Messer, professor of theological bioethics here at Baylor University. But before we get back to our conversation, I wanted to tell you about a new Baylor University Press book that I think you'll like. The book is called Autism and Worship, A Liturgical Theology by Armand Leon Van Ammen, a co-director of Aberdeen's Center for Autism and Theology. In this book, Van Ammen recounts the experiences of autistic people and considers how those experiences might reframe liturgical theology and the worship practices of the church. This book includes analysis of data about autistic people and the church, a close look at a church that might provide a paradigm for renewal in Christian worship, and an important contribution to liturgical theology. You can buy Autism and Worship now, wherever you get your books. Okay, back to my conversation with Neil Messer. So you've given us a lot to think about in terms of why neuroethics is significant.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about your own work and how you have tried to make neuroethics a point of significant conversation within theological ethics, Christian theological ethics specifically.
Right. Well, My first major foray into this field, I'd published one or two articles mm-hmm. before this, but my first major kind of intervention in the field was my 2017 book, Theological Neuroethics,
mm-hmm.
And what I was quite explicitly setting out to do in that book was to try and address and begin to overcome this mutual neglect that I'd, yeah. I'd identified.
Yeah.
So I wanted to show what a particular kind of Christian ethical tradition would do and could do, mm-hmm. If it engaged with neuroethics as a field. So I was setting out to make a distinctively Christian contribution to a series of neuroethical debates. But the book was also intended to be, if you like, a proof of concept. It was intended to demonstrate that both to my Christian ethics colleagues that this is a field that they should be taking an interest in and getting involved in.
Right.
But also it was intended to, you know, to demonstrate to any neuroethicists who were listening that a Christian theological tradition of ethics had some distinctive and valuable and important things to bring to the table, to bring mm-hmm. to neuroethical conversations. So what I do in that book, having initially I try and do a bit of ground clearing to try and address some of the reasons on both sides for this mutual neglect of neuroethics mm-hmm. and theology.
Right.
Having done that, I then work through a series of neuroethical discussions. Okay. Which span this range from the neuroscience of ethics to the ethics of neuroscience.
Great.
And try to show how the particular kind of Christian theological and ethical tradition I work in, which is a broadly reformed theological and ecclesial tradition, how this kind of Christian ethical tradition might engage with these debates.
Mm-hmm.
And what I argue is that often there's the Christian ethical contribution to mm-hmm. To these debates is not only going to consist in offering answers to the questions as they're commonly framed, but actually reframing the questions and the debates.
Yeah. Could you give us a few examples of the debates that you engage in that book?
I start off with a debate that was, or an area of discussion that was very lively from the early 2000s mm-hmm. Through to certainly the mid 2010s or so.
Sure.
About the neuroscience of moral judgment. I focus on some neuroscientific work on moral judgment mm-hmm. By a neuroscientist and philosopher called Joshua Green, which attracted a lot of attention through that period and also attracted a lot of controversy.
Right.
And I survey the controversies about his work and the critiques that it's subject to by other neuroscientists and philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
But what Green, part of what Green takes himself to be doing is on neuroscientific grounds, debunking pretty much every system and tradition of moral reasoning except utilitarianism.
Oh, no. Fascinating.
So I start off by mapping the scientific and philosophical arguments about all that, but what I go on to argue in the second half of that chapter of the book is that Green might turn out. I mean, if he's right, and that's a very big if.
Sure.
I mean, if his science is right, and if he's right about his debunking, that mm-hmm. might turn out. To make him an unwitting and possibly unwilling ally to the kind of Christian ethical tradition that I'm working in,
mm.
which is often animated by a profound theological suspicion of ethics as a human project.
Sure.
So I'm thinking here of, you know, particularly of theologians like Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer,
sure,
who are highly critical of ethics as a human project to know about mm-hmm. good and evil out of our own resources,
right?
And if that's the theological way that one thinks about ethics, so Bonhoeffer, in one fragment of his ethics, says something to the effect that the knowledge of good and evil would appear to be the starting point of all ethics. The first task of Christian ethics is to translations vary, invalidate or overcome or supersede the knowledge of good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's your starting point, if you need to do that kind of ground clearing before you can move on to the constructive task of Christian ethics, some scientific and philosophical debunking might actually be helpful in that ground clearing task. So Green might turn out to be an unwitting ally if he's right.
Yeah.
If he's not right, then not too much hangs on that. But
sure.
But that's one example of the kind of reframing mm-hmm. that I've sought to do. Or again, in a more recent piece of work that I did after the book was published, I tackled a more practically focused neuroethical question
mm-hmm.
About what's sometimes known as brain reading, or sometimes known as neuroscience-based mind reading, using functional brain imaging
mm-hmm.
to gain information about subjects' mental states or thoughts. And a lot of the ethical concerns that neuroscience-based mind reading raises, not surprisingly, are about mental privacy.
Right.
In this article that I published 2 or 3 years back, I again start off by surveying some of the science and the philosophical debates about the ethics of privacy, which mm-hmm. which is often framed in terms of a rights-based discourse.
Right.
But then I take quite a deep dive into the theological ethics of communication and privacy.
Yeah.
And argue that privacy is still important for Christian ethicists to think about, but theological ethicists will need to think about privacy in very different ways, because they'll need to think about knowledge,
right?
Knowledge of ourselves and one another
mm-hmm.
in very different ways from the standard set of assumptions about what kind of knowledge we're seeking through a technique like neuroscience-based mind reading.
Yeah. I'm curious too, from 6 years on from your book, and you've published some other things since then, what are some of the things in your own work that, when you talk to folks who have read your book or who've come across your essays, what are people paying attention to? Do you have a sense of what aspects of this work are drawing the most interest at this point in time?
I think people get interested in the whole range of things I've done. So people are interested in the theoretical side of it,
mm-hmm.
And also in the practical ethical questions. So the final chapter of my neuroethics book is focused on, again, an issue that's been around for longer than neuroethics has.
Mm-hmm.
But takes a distinctive kind of
right.
form in the neuroethical context, namely the ethics of human enhancement technologies.
Right.
So in that chapter of the book, I focus on on enhancements of neural function. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the specific example I choose is pharmacological cognitive enhancement. So the particular practical question I focus on is whether it's morally acceptable for students to take smart drugs to try and enhance their grades.
Right.
Answering that question well, I argue, requires quite a deep dive into some theological considerations about mm-hmm. how humans live and act in the world.
Yeah.
I utilize an analytical framework that I actually developed in some of my earlier work in relation to other questions about ethical questions about other areas of biology and biotechnology,
mm-hmm.
Which I refer to as a set of diagnostic questions for assessing pretty much any new technology that requires ethical assessment in a Christian mm-hmm. framework. So I use and also adapt and further develop this analytical framework in relation to this neuroethical debate, and I think people have picked up on that as well and found that that kind of approach to practical ethical questions also helpful and potentially fruitful.
Yeah, great. So I'm curious, you have just come to Baylor this year. I'm curious if you think that Baylor University as an institution will equip or support your work on these issues in unique ways.
Very much so. One of the things that really attracted me to Baylor and to the position I now have here was the prospect of working in a Christian R1 university
mm-hmm.
where there are people all around the university who are genuinely interested in collaborating with a theological ethicist.
Yeah.
So it's in the nature of neuroethics to be highly interdisciplinary.
Right.
I mean, you really do need to be getting into conversation with neuroscientists and psychologists, among others.
Mm-hmm.
And so the opportunity to work in a highly rated research university,
yeah,
which also has, has a strong and clearly articulated Christian identity, where there's, among other things, that there's an outstanding psychology and neuroscience department that has people in it who are really keen to collaborate with theologians and ethicists.
Yeah.
is just a fantastic opportunity. From all I've seen and heard since I first started thinking about coming here, and certainly from all I've experienced since I arrived here. And Baylor is a great environment to do the kind of work I want to do.
Great. Well, we're glad to have you here. Dr. Neil Messer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening in today. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, you might enjoy some of our previous episodes. You might specifically be interested in the episodes that feature Aaron Rafferty and Devin Stahl. Also, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And it would help us out a ton if you left a review or shared this episode. Those little acts make it easier for more people to find out about this episode and also this whole podcast. Next week, I'll be speaking with Baylor professors Lainey Scales and Joao Chavez about their work with the Baptist Scholars International Roundtable and their new book about the Kingdom of God in the Baptist tradition. Until then, take care.